Russia is always something the Crispyolfians have had on their minds ever since Brother Thomas, of course, clarified the scriptures in that regard. And I think many today who are looking at their Bibles really think that Russia is the key to what's likely to happen in the very near future in our world. And the war going on in Ukraine is on everybody's mind. It has been for more than 2 years now. We thought that Russia would sweep in and take over Ukraine very quickly. It hasn't been that way because God had other things in mind to take place between then and now. And certainly, if you could say so, Putin has been readied for war in a greater way than he was before. His key idea and concept is that for the present time, he wants to restore the former glory of Russia, going back centuries, right back to the origins of Russia, I guess, the Rus people in the area of Kiev and Rus, way back before 1000 AD. So a long time ago, there was a great and mighty power led by Vladimir the Great. And everybody realises, and we know as Bible students, that Ukraine can't win. But it's been prolonged, sadly, with all sorts of human misery. And America knows, the world knows, that Ukraine cannot beat Russia. What's in the back of Putin's mind at the moment as he is gradually making progress is anybody's guess, I suppose, but we do know that Russia will take over that area and extend beyond it. Terrible, terrible times happening in that country now, and we're sad to see it, of course. Now, this slide was prepared by Brother Jim. So, in a way, this is the only slide of his in my talk, but in a way, he's here with us now. So, Putin's ambition is to restore the Kievan Rus, the capital of medieval Kievan Rus from 879 to 1240. Vladimir the Great was the great ruler, of course, the first great Russian empire. And Putin has always regarded Ukraine as a part of Russia. And he described some few years ago the fall of the USSR, the Soviet Union, as the greatest geopolitical disaster in history, as far as he was concerned. And he is a historian. He's very much au fait with the history of Russia going way back. He's a very intelligent man, in fact. But Brother Thomas, of course, gave us these words in Elpis Israel, and we treasure these words. The future movements of Russia, he said, are notable signs of the time because they are predicted in the scriptures of truth. The Russian autocracy in its plenitude, in its fullness, in its full development, and on the verge of dissolution, as you can see the image being dissolved on the right-hand side there, on the verge of dissolution, it's the image of Nebuchadnezzar standing on the mountains of Israel, ready to be smitten by the stone. We read that in Daniel 2, and we just read the details in Ezekiel chapter 38. Wonderful words. Everybody can probably recite them. When Russia makes its grand move for the building up of its image empire, that image into an empire, then let the reader know the end of all things as at present constituted is at hand. And here's a wonderful message for us, the exhortation for us. The long expected but stealthy advent of the King of Israel will be on the eve of becoming a fact. It's about to happen, brothers and sisters and young people. It's about to happen. And salvation will be those who not only look for it but have trimmed their lamps by believing the gospel of the kingdom under the obedience of faith and the perfection thereof in fruits meet for repentance. Well, it's a wonderful message for us, isn't it? There's no doubt about that. And and there is Rosh. And all the countries around it mentioned in Ezekiel chapter 38. And we just read the first couple of verses. The word of Yahweh came to me saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the great ruler, the man at the top, the land of Magog. You see Magog on the map there. We'll talk a bit more about Magog shortly. The chief prince, or the prince of Rosh, Meshach and Tubal, running across through Muscovy and into towards Siberia, prophesy against that power who's in control of that area. And you can see Rosh there on the map, quite central in the regions which are in conflict at this very moment. Now, why hasn't Russia used some nuclear weapons? They've been threatening it for some time. We, of course, can't be sure whether there might be some limited nuclear weapons tried out, even as this war progresses. There have certainly been lots of threats of it. But look at what the world is like today and how many times over it could destroy itself. That's the number of nuclear weapons held by various nuclear-armed powers around the world. And the total, when this graph was done just not too long ago, 13,000 and more nuclear weapons. And they're there, you know, through many, many countries. North Korea is said to have 45, Israel is said to have 90, Pakistan, and on it goes, right up to, of course, France and China. And then look at the huge quantities the United States has, and Russia even more.
To hear Vladimir Putin tell it, the cruise missile carried by this rocket is basically unstoppable. Flying at 20 times the speed of sound, it can zig and zag and deliver a nuclear warhead to any target in the world.
Система отличается способностью совершать полеты.
It goes like a meteorite to its target, boasted Putin, like a fireball. It was a provocative Cold War-style threat, and the audience of lawmakers and business leaders loved it.
Awesome.
The animation is sobering. Russian missiles that could circumnavigate the planet. Nuclear-powered cruise missiles hugging the terrain that could fly effectively forever, with targets that could be anywhere.
No bluff. Putin says he's not bluffing, and he's right. He can do this. There aren't many things that Russia can do well. Build big missiles with large nuclear weapons on them that can destroy our country. They've had a lot of practice.
Should we be freaked out?
We should be freaked out.
Deterrence, just a fancy word for fear of what these weapons can do. The force of the atom bomb that demolished Hiroshima was around 15 kilotons. The force of maybe 15,000 tons of dynamite. The force of a modern nuclear weapon ranges up to 50 megatons. And there are a lot of them. North Korea has maybe 15. Israel, India, Pakistan, the UK, China, and France all have a lot more. And now, take a deep breath. The US and Russia stockpile.
As we know, God is in control, and those things won't go to that extent. But the world is threatened with all sorts of potential self-destruction. So the Lord Jesus Christ can't be very far away when you consider all of these circumstances and military build-ups happening all around the world. And every country now is building up its armaments, even little Australia. So Michael Parkinson, the great interviewer, he once said, "I really wanted to interview Vladimir Putin." Of course, he doesn't interview anymore, but in November 22, he said, this is the person I really would have liked to have interviewed. Any self-respecting journalist would want to do an interview with President Putin. He's the man who controls us. We're in the palm of his hand. Our fate is there. He was a very intelligent man, Michael Parkinson. I mean, we're in a terrible political situation. Putin has caused this concern. What's he about? What are his plans? What does he really want to achieve? Do they really want a worldwide conflict or nuclear war? These are the questions that most certainly will affect us all unless you find a solution to a problem of his, that is Putin's, creating. Well, we know that, whether we call him a journalist or not, certainly an interviewer, Tucker Carlson, did get an interview with Putin. And it was viewed around the world millions and millions of times. And very, very interesting insight into the mind of Vladimir Putin. And early on, he gave a half-hour history lesson. He said, "I'll only keep you a couple of minutes while I go through some history of Russia." Went on for half an hour. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
So if you don't mind, I will take only 30 seconds or 1 minute to give you a short reference to history, for giving you a little historical background.
Please.
Well, rather than limit himself to just 30 seconds or a minute, Putin goes on for something like half an hour to give a great and detailed history of Russia, but in particular, what we want to look at is where he talks about the baptism of Rus.
The next very significant date in the history of Russia was 988. This was the baptism of Russia when Prince Vladimir, the great-grandson of Rurik, baptized Russia and adopted Orthodoxy or Eastern Christianity. From this time, the centralized Russian state began to strengthen. Why? Because of the single territory, integrated economic ties, one and the same language, and after the baptism of Russia, the same faith and rule of the prince. The centralized Russian state began to take shape.
So he talks about the baptism of the Rus, which took place in 988 AD at a time when the people of Rus under Vladimir the Great turned to Christianity. He was actually looking for some kind of religion that would tie his disparate empire together. He thought one religion was a good idea. Of course, we know that is the best idea yet to come. But what he did was he forced all of his people to be baptized. He married a Christian princess from Constantinople. The princess said, I'm not going to marry you unless you're a Christian, as the faith was then in Constantinople. And so he agreed with that, and he got the whole country to become Christian. So there's a background to the Russian Orthodox Church. And Putin knows that it's good to have religion, because communism had no religion, but he had brought religion back into the country as a sense of uniting his people. What is he? He's a king of fierce countenance, says Daniel chapter 8. And he wants sole rule, and he wants all the people to be united and kind of uniform underneath him. And of course, he has a very close tie with the Orthodox Church there, and also somewhat with the papacy. But he's a ruthless man, isn't he? And any of his critics just do not stand a chance. They had an election just recently. Funnily enough, he won by 90-odd percent of the vote, I think, or something. Nobody can stand against him, let's face it. And there was Alexander Litvinenko a number of years ago in London. I sat down for a cup of tea, and a couple of weeks later, he's poisoned from that cup of tea. Yevgeny Prigozhin, who rebelled against him, led a little mutiny against him, he was gone. And then, lo and behold, a couple of months ago, his greatest opposition, who was already in prison and they tried to poison him, he was dead.
In the last hour, it's been confirmed that Yevgeny Prigozhin, head of the Wagner Group, was on board the private jet that crashed near Moscow.
Caught on camera, the final seconds of a private jet. On board, reportedly, the head of the Wagner mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin. Look over there by the farm. It's burning, the eyewitness can be heard saying. In the distance, a giant cloud of smoke. The Embraer plane had crashed in the Tver region of Russia, north of Moscow. Mr. Prigozhin's right-hand man, Wagner commander Dmitry Utkin, is also thought to have been on board. Later, a Wagner-linked telegram channel confirmed that Yevgeny Prigozhin had been killed.
Yes, well, they held an investigation at the Russian authorities and found out that it was aircraft malfunction.
Okay.
I think when a missile hits a plane in the right place, a plane tends to malfunction, and that's what happens. Well, you know, all of these situations are under the control of this very fierce leader. Now, the question is, we know already that rockets have been fired to the far west of Ukraine, and some have actually entered into the airspace of Poland. The question that was asked in this interview by Tucker Carlson that was a very interesting and important one was, can you imagine Russian troops going into Poland? Well, we know that they're going to go a lot further. We read our scriptures. But the world doesn't know that. But what's the answer? Let's have a look.
Can you imagine a scenario where you sent Russian troops to Poland?
Only in one case, if Poland attacks Russia. Why? Because we have no interest in Poland, Latvia, or anywhere else. Why would we do that? We simply don't have any interest. Only in one case, if Poland attacks Russia. Only in one case, if Poland attacks Russia.
On the 1st of September 1939, German forces invaded Poland in a move that was to trigger the Second World War.
During the night of the 31st of August, Nazi SS troops dressed themselves in Polish uniforms and staged an attack on the Gliwice radio tower in Upper Silesia. This false flag operation was part of a wider series of staged attacks on Germans and German property called Operation Himmler, that was designed to make it appear as if Poland was exercising aggression against Germany. Just hours after the Gliwice incident, at 4:45 a.m. on the 1st of September, the first of approximately 1.5 million German troops launched their attack on Poland.
No intent, Hitler said, to go into Poland. Next day he's there. A false flag operation. Only if they attack first. Well, it looked like the Poles would attack first, but they were Nazi soldiers dressed up as Polish. And that was the start of the Second World War. So Putin's not averse to playing those kind of tricks either. Now, Russia's Medvedev, he was the president for a little while, keeping a seat warm for Putin where the constitution required that he couldn't rule for another term. Now he's changed that constitution, he can rule almost forever. But meanwhile, he put in his little mate, Mr. Medvedev, and only a few, a short while ago in March, Medvedev said, he's the deputy chairman now of the Security Council, ally of President Putin. He described Ukraine on Monday, the 4th of March, as part of Russia, and said what he called the historical parts of Russia needed to come home. A bellicose presentation. You wonder, such a big voice from such a little fellow. A bellicose presentation that suggested Russia's military goals in Ukraine are far-reaching. Medvedev. He says that the Soviet. He said Moscow would prosecute the special military operation, as they call it, not a war, special military operation, until the Ukrainian leadership capitulated. We know that's going to happen. So back looking at Roche and the countries which will be with Russia. Now, I wanted to clarify the questions which some have asked about Magog and Goma. And Magog and Goma, both sons of Japheth. Japheth actually had seven sons, and we know that the majority of the Western world, we would say, comes from Japheth, certainly the areas through Europe and Russia. Japheth, the son of Noah, this is quoted from Brother Thomas in Elders Israel, and he in turn is quoting Josephus. And in this section, very good section in Elders Israel on Magog and Gomer, he quotes a number of historians, including Strabo, Josephus, Herodotus, Diodorus Siculus, to give the background and the reasons why we understand where Goma and Magog are and how they will align with Russia. This is telling us that the whole of Europe will be aligned with Russia. And so, quoting from Josephus, he had seven sons, Japheth, proceeding from their primitive seats in the mountains of Taurus and Amanus. Now, they're actually in Turkey, Asia Minor. Those mountains, they ascended Asia to the river Tanay or Don. Now that's the Donetsk region we hear a lot about in Ukraine. It's the Don River and a little tributary to the Don River, that region. So they went up that far, the other side north of the Black Sea, I'll show on a map shortly, and they entered Europe and they penetrated as far westward as the Straits of Gibraltar. That's all mainland Europe. So they went right across there, occupying lands which they successively met within their progress, all of which were uninhabited. Why? Because the flood had wiped everybody out. So there was nobody there. So the sons of Japheth went and went through all that area. And we read of Gomer and all his bands in Ezekiel 38. That's the many tribes of Gomer as they went through that whole territory. And so also for Magog. Now, just reading on. They bequeathed their names to their different families or nations. And Goma founded the Gomari, whom the Greeks at that time called the Galatae, and that Magog founded the Magogae, whom the Greeks called Scythae, the Scythians. We've heard of the Scythians. So moving along, this is my rough drafting on the map of where these tribes went. So Goma, and later on many of them were known as the tribes of the Celts. They're in the red, and they move from that area, as you can see there in kind of western Turkey, and they lived on the high tablelands, where the Apostle Paul went and preached in that area of Galatia. And that name is still there. The Gauls, Galatia is still there. But most of them have moved right through Europe. And there was nobody there. They occupied all those territories. Magog, on the other hand, we don't read any about any descendants of Magog's names, but they became the Scythians. And all the historians are at one that Magog became the Scythians. And the Scythians went right across to Germany, up to the north, and right across to the east as well. So they're big territories. They're all going to be combined together to come down into Israel for the Battle of Armageddon. Now, Colossians chapter 3, the Apostle Paul is writing to the Colossians, and he mentions the Scythians. It's the only time the Scythians are mentioned in the Bible. And he says of those who lived in that area of Colossae, which is in that territory where these two tribes began, and he mentions the barbarians and the Scythians. Now, the barbarians were those who didn't speak the language. Remember when Paul and Barnabas went to Lystra and they met those that even they couldn't understand the language briefly, even with their gift of tongues. So they were the barbarian people there. And the Scythians were there as well. So we know that, we know what Josephus said and the other historians, that's where they all originated, but they spread out from that area. But some remain in that area. And Paul says, you've got some of those in your ecclesias. They're neither Greek nor Jew, circumcision or uncircumcision, barbarian, Scythian, bond or free. We're all one in Christ, he says. So that's where they originated. So let's get a feeling of in particular, the sons of Japheth. Japheth had Gomer, his firstborn, and we do read of Gomer's descendants. We don't know anything about Magog's descendants from the Bible, but they were the Scythians who occupied Central Europe. Madai is the third son. That is the Medes. You can see the area they occupied. Javan is the J is an I. The Ionians, they don't have a J in Greek. It's Y. But anyway, Tubal, Siberia. Meshech is Muscovy. And Tiraz, the seventh son, settled in Thrace. Thrace was sort of Western Macedonia, Western Greece, we might say. And they moved across to Italy. Their descendants included the Etruscans, Tuscany in northern Italy, the Tyrrhenians, who were proudly known as pirates, and they all along that area of Naples and the coast there for centuries. The people feared the Tyrrhenians. Javan actually was in Greek, settled all the Greek islands, and we're told that Javan settled all the islands in the Mediterranean and Tarshish. And there is a story about one of the descendants of Javan who was blown across by that terrible wind that blows westward in the Mediterranean, blown out through the Pillars of Hercules, which is the Straits of Gibraltar, and went to Tarshish. So the Greeks actually were the first settlers in Britain, Tarshish. And it's interesting that Prince Philip, who married Queen Elizabeth, was of Greek extraction. So there's a closeness there between the Greeks and Britain. Of course, later on, others from Gomer and possibly even Magog went across to Britain as well. But they're the areas we're talking about. So we're quite right in talking about Gomer and Magog as we do. Now, Magog, father of the Scythians are interesting people, very warlike people. And they occupied the area known as the steppes. You can see in green on the map there, right across from Central Europe, right across to the east. Now, the steppes are, in Canada, I think they call them the prairies, maybe in America too. The prairies, they're the grassland, the rolling grassland. And the people who live on there become naturally nomadic. And the Scythians in particular learn to be horsemen, good horsemen. Horses, of course, are terrific for going across all that kind of country. But they went, travelled far and wide in all of that territory. So they're known as the great nomadic warriors. So they learnt the bow and arrow and how to shoot bow and arrow well from on horses. Now, it's interesting, in Ezekiel chapter 38, we read these things. I will bring thee forth an all thine army, horses and horsemen, because this is Magog's characteristics. Horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armour, a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. That's the Scythian characteristic. the nomadic horsemen of the steppes down through the centuries. Well, today, of course, they don't use horses and horsemen so much, but tanks are terrific in that territory as well. And just on the 19th of April, a few days ago, Russia's defense minister, Mr. Shoigu, says that the tank production is booming because that's what they're going to roll through Europe, all through those areas where they can go through undulating territory. That's why the war in Ukraine, you're seeing so many tanks going through. They're ideal for that kind of battle. And horsemen have become tanks and all kinds of armour in Ezekiel chapter 38. Now, the Scythian Empire, we oughtn't to confine the Scythian Empire to a small territory, because the Syrians, actually the last great manifestation of them, I suppose, as a horde, was with the Huns. Hun giving its name to Hungary, of course. Hungary has got the steppes, the rolling hills in there. But there's the Huns moving from about 150 AD in the east, right across under the leadership of Attila the Hun, right through until 451 on that map. That whole area there is Scythia, which means it's Magog.
That's deep.
It's Magog. So that whole territory is going to be involved with Russia. We don't limit the great power of Russia to have control over all of Europe. And here is a map with a couple of quotes from Brother Thomas, which identifies the fact that the Scythians or Magog come right across to the Rhine River. That's the Blue River running right down there in the middle. So the Magog territory comes right across to the Rhine, and Goma on the other side meets them at the Rhine. So Brother Thomas says, the west of Europe, ancient Gaul, Belgium, the countries bordering upon them, which constituted in our day the Napoleon Empire. Brother Thomas, of course, still regarded as his day, the Napoleon Empire, a few years before he was born, but that's all right. In our day, it was that area was all Napoleon's. Goma then points immediately to France, he says. Magog, on the other hand, is the region extending from the Rus, or Russia, right across to the Rhine, comprehending in his day countries called Wallachia, Transylvania, Hungary, and Germany. So clearly, we're talking about the whole of mainland Europe coming together. The King of the North and Gog and the little horn of the Gog to one and the same power in control of Constantinople and right across Europe to Europe as well. Now, we're not sure how soon that's going to be, but we don't need to be here. To be here, to see all of that happen. It can happen very, very quickly that powers will see the need to fall in line with Russia because, as Ezekiel 38 says, Russia will be a guard to them. So, Mr. Putin wears a number of hats or crowns, we might say. He is, well, we don't know whether it's him, the leader of Russia, let's say. He fits the bill, but the leader of Russia is, in the scriptures, Gog. He's also King of the North in Daniel 11, and he's also the little horn of Daniel chapter 8. We're going to give a summary of what those people do. But look at the power of this man.
Слава нашим доблестным вооруженным силам! За Россию! За победу! Ура!
Actor.
Just picking up those words of that song, our Soviet Union will punish the whole world from Europe to the Neva in the east. Now, the Neva is the river of St. Petersburg. So all that territory, they're saying, we will have control of all of that territory, and we will punish anybody who doesn't fall in line with us. And that's their national thinking. But Russia's on the road to ruins. They might not be driving tanks, they might be driving motorbikes, I'm not too sure. Isn't that lovely artwork that was put together by our Chris Nielsen video brothers and sisters in England? So Russia is on the road to ruin. The situation clearly is that, as we'll be talking about, and Brother Andrew will be talking more about, the invasion of Israel brings them to their ruin at the Battle of Armageddon. Now, as we said, Putin wears those three hats, or the leader of Russia wears those three hats. And we've seen already, Mr. Putin likes to be number one, nobody alongside him, the one at the top. We know that the idea of the word Gog and Rosh mean one who is at the head or at the top. That's exactly the kind of person that Putin wants to be. And the leader of Russia in the latter day will be, whether it's him or another soon to come. He seems to fit the bill, doesn't he? So if we look at the little horn of Daniel chapter 8 and read about his end, it's there in the yellow, but let's just look at it. In the latter time of their kingdom, says Daniel, when the transgressors are come to the full, don't tell me this world's transgressors haven't come to the full. Obviously and clearly they have come to the full. And a king of fierce countenance, understanding dark sentences, one who understands human nature, one who understands how to manipulate people, one who understands how to put fear in the hearts of people and to take control. This is this man. His power shall be mighty, not by his own power. He shall destroy wonderfully and prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people, the Jewish people. And through his policy, he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. The word craft means deceit. He's a deceiver. And so often he is. He's one thing to your face and another thing behind your back, totally. He shall magnify himself in his heart. Well, we saw that. And by peace shall destroy many. It's just a special military operation. But he shall stand up against the prince of princes, says Daniel in chapter 8, and he shall be broken without hand. What about his other iteration, the king of the north? Again in the yellow, he comes to his end. At the time of the end, which we know began in 1917, King of the South pushed the Turks out of the Holy Land. Then, later on, the King of the North comes against him. That's soon, surely. With chariots and horsemen and many ships, he shall enter into the glorious land, and in the countries, many countries will be overthrown. He stretches forth his hand also against the land of Egypt. He'll have power over the treasures of gold and silver and all the precious things in Egypt. Total control there. And then he goes forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. As he goes to the area of Jerusalem, plants the tabernacle of his palace, his headquarters, between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, but it's the road to ruin. He shall come to his end and none shall help him. And the other quotation, of course, our reading in Ezekiel chapter 38 and through to chapter 39. In Ezekiel chapter 38, God is against him when he comes down, the chief prince of Rosh and Meshach and Tubal. I'll turn thee back, I'll put hooks in thy jaws and bring thee forth and all thine army, and thou shalt ascend and come like a storm, like a cloud that'll cover the land. It will be many bands and many people with thee. And he thinks an evil thought and says, I'll go up to the land of unwarred villages. So as Brother Andrew is going to tell us, that it will be the land of unwarred villages, Israel. Interesting, isn't it? I'll go to them that are at rest, well, safely, to take a spoil, to take a prey. But God's fury comes up in his face. Verse 17 of Ezekiel 38. Art thou he of whom I have spoken in old time by my servant the prophets? Surely he is. That I would prophesied many years, even since Brother Thomas' day. We've been saying this for many years, but it's going to happen, and soon. So in verse 18, my fury shall come up in my face. And in chapter 39, verse 4, thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel. It's the road to ruin. Brothers and sisters, the time is getting short for all of us. Having seen all these things developing, now seeing them coming to a peak, where are we? Daniel talks about the time of trouble. And he says, at that time, thy people shall be delivered. Everyone that shall be found written in the book. We want to be in that book, brothers and sisters. We believe we're in that book. We don't want to be rubbed out of the book. Many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. But they that shall be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. We can't imagine the beauty and the glory that is soon to be revealed upon this earth. This wicked earth is going to be swept away, and in will come righteousness, justice, and peace everywhere. The brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness, as the stars forever and ever. Where are we, brothers and sisters? Bridegroom is coming. Five were wise, five were foolish. Matthew 25, these are words we always think of on prophecy days and times when we're talking about the wonderful things that have been revealed for us. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour when the Son of Man cometh. We don't know. It could be this afternoon. We don't know. We're all here ready and waiting. Lord, come quickly, we pray. Let's trim our lamps, brothers and sisters, and be ready. Our Lord is coming.